Okay. Good morning. What a blessing to gather here again this morning and seek the Lord for another day together. It's a good day yesterday, and surely the Lord is in this place. We're thankful for that. We're blessed to be here with you this week. I want to thank you for your the interest and the comments and the questions that came yesterday. And I just want to say again here at the beginning, please feel free to do that. Just raise your hand anytime if you need clarification. The last thing I want to do is come here and drop off a bunch of information and go on my way. I want to try to stimulate you. The job of a teacher is to stimulate his students, to teach them things, but to stimulate them to learn and to study and to look after and look into the matter even more deeply. So I want to try to stimulate some of those desires in your hearts here this week. And I sense that you have students among you, and that's a blessing. We need to learn how to study. I remember back in 2000, I think it was 2006. Was that the first year Brother Denny had a CBI? Yes. Were you there, Brother Abner? You wasn't able to make it. Yeah, 3-week young men's Bible school. I was able to go there. And early in the week, we had a lot of assignments. But earlier in the week, he asked us, who all here likes to study? You know how Brother Denny could. And I put my hand up, and I started looking around, and there weren't many other hands up. And most of them caught the difference, I think. And I didn't realize as much that day. But he went on to say that, you know, study is work. And I realized that I probably really like to read more than I like to study. And there is a little difference. And that's what he was trying to point out. And so that's why not more raised their hand, I think. I was the one that didn't really get what he was saying. But his study is work, but it's also good for us. It is good for us to, it takes discipline. And sometimes I think, we'll go through these sessions, you'll see I'm not an advocate of higher education per se, so to speak. And I do feel like it had an influence in the Mennonite church that did not bring fruit that was positive in the long run. However, sometimes in our homeschooling situations, we can lower almost our standard of education, and especially study. When you get to the high school grades, and maybe a lot of us don't do high school grades, but there's something in a discipline for a young man to have to sit there and study. And I think I just want to encourage us. We don't dare to lose among us students. Students that are able to study the Word and study history, of course, you know that's a burden on my heart and other things. Just quickly this morning, why are a few reasons that we should study church history? Just to take a few, we're not going to go through the whole list. Anyone? I'll repeat them so you don't need the mic. What are some of the reasons why we should study church history? We talked about them yesterday. So we don't make the same mistakes, that's right. So we can see where we're going. We can look at where those people were at times, and then we can say, oh, that's where we are. And that's where they went. That's where we're headed because of the same influences. What are some other things? Cause and effect. That's right. We can see what worked and what didn't work. We can see fruits. And many times you'll see here, we'll be looking at this more today, but seeds are sown and then those fruits, they appear in a generation or two later. And that's the sobering thing because we're sowing seeds. We're all going through life with our corn planter down, our 20-row corn planter, 15-row, they don't have 15 rows. They have 8 rows or 12 rows. We're all going through life with our corn. We're planting seeds every day. We're just planting away. And it's a lot of times it's sometime later that we get to see what we really planted. And as churches, that's a sobering thing. And so church history, we can look at where them churches were, where the different influences that came in and how it affected the church and where it took them. So, and then another one, I like to think of this. We can see where we're at. Sometimes, you know, in a map, it's hard to see where you're going if you don't know where you're at. First thing you have to do on a map is there's an arrow there that says you are here many times. You got to find out where you're at, and then you can figure out where you're going. Church history helps us to see, ooh, this is where we're at. Maybe we need to take some note here where we're going. Our series title for this week is The Old Mennonite Church in the Spirit of Progress. And I know it's a little confusing. I want to just write up here on the board to try to help us with this. On the conservative side, who do we have on the conservative side of the three main branches that we're looking at in Mennonite church history? Who are the conservatives? The Old Order Mennonites. We'll just put Old Order. And who were the progressive ones? General Conference. Thank you. It's just called General Conference. And who are we looking at that was considered by historians, and they consider themselves to be kind of in the middle of the road? The Old Mennonite Church, it's called, or just put down Old Mennonite Church. Now, none of that's a... Yeah. Okay, so here we have them to help you keep it straight, and help me as well, maybe. So those are the three branches. Now, we tried to establish yesterday these three. There are more smaller groups that broke off, but today these are going to kind of fall away, and we'll try to focus in on this one in the next 4 or 5 sessions. I'm not saying I'll never refer to the others, but our focus is going to be to try to follow them, their history from about 1850, 1860 to later in the 1900s, and watch their some of the things that came in. Now, I want to say this morning, I wish that Jesus Christ was here to teach this session. I know He's here spiritually, but I wish I could sit at His feet and hear Him teach on church history. I think of Revelations, the first three chapters, and I think of Him as John saw Him in the midst of those seven golden candlesticks. What did those seven golden candlesticks represent? Churches, seven churches. And then He had a word, He had a message for all seven of those churches there in chapter 2 and chapter 3. Do you think He had a message for these people? Do you think He had a message for these people? How about these people? Do you think He has a message for us? He does. I wish He would be here to tell us today that this is what happened. This is exactly what happened to these people. And this is how they were transformed from a peculiar people into general American society and culture. I wish He was here to do that for us. Yes, John.
Yeah. This is about one thing I learned about history from studying history. One thing that stood out to me was how a lot of godly, powerful leaders made some profound mistakes. And I don't say that to that they, we criticize.
They made profound what?
They made some mistakes. Profound mistakes.
Thank you. Yes.
And I don't say that so that we look critically at our leaders. Am I still on? Jesus there in Revelations, or that to the churches there, we can take that as an example.
Yes.
Of how we should look at these things, but
that's good.
That was very profound as I studied history to realize, and we should look at it the same way, that even though somebody is very gifted and very godly, we can make some mistakes.
Yes, that is right.
And
that's right. And what should that do to us, brother?
What should that do to us?
Yes.
Humble us, I guess.
Humble us and break us. I think humility goes a long ways, because we are going to make mistakes. We have to understand that. God's probably not going to use us because we do everything right. It'll probably be in spite of ourselves in some ways. But it's a very good point, and we cannot separate men from movements. And so that's part of my thing today. We're going to look at some men who had tremendous influence in a beautiful, powerful ways, and at the same time, they also left influence that were seeds that sprouted and brought fruit in a generation or two that I know that they would not have been happy with the fruits that came out of that. So that's very sobering. Thank you for that. That's why I say I wish Jesus was here to teach it, because I know that He could open up to us the things that were wrong, mistakes they made, and do it in a gracious way in humility without squashing anyone. And that's my heart. I want to try to do that. Okay, so our series title, The Old Mennonite Church in the Spirit of Progress. Our subtitle for today is called The Mennonite Great Awakening. The Mennonite Great Awakening, 1860 to 1900. The Mennonite Great Awakening, or as the scholars, more later scholars have termed it, they just call it the quickening. The quickening. And it's probably 1860s, a little early. They probably look at it more in the mid 1870s to the 1900s, but we're going to look from 1860 to 1900, the Mennonite Great Awakening. Okay, the series title, I want to make a few comments there. I just want to take a few minutes here and talk about the rest of this title. We talked about the old Mennonite church yesterday. We tried to establish who we're talking about this week. And the rest of the title is The Spirit of Progress. So we want to talk about that a little bit. The Elkhart Institute in Elkhart, Indiana was one of the first, it was, as far as I know, the first institution of higher education. It was not a four-year college course. It was, I think, a two-year, what do you call that? A two-year, a two-year college or whatever. We'll call it that. I'm sorry. I'm sure that's not the right word. But it was the forerunner of Goshen College. And as far as I know, I think Elkhart Institute was the first institution of higher learning that this church here established and took responsibility for. The church did not establish it, by the way. It was some prominent businessmen and some John F. Funk that we'll talk about today and John S. Kaufman. Some of those men had a burden and they established it. It wasn't the church that did it. That might be some of the problem with that. But anyway, it was founded in 1894, and then I think it was around 1908 that transitioned into become Goshen College. And we'll talk more about that in one of our other sessions this week. But anyway, in 1896, John S. Kaufman, who we'll learn about here today more, he gave a resounding speech there at this institute. That's what it is. It's an institute. Elkhart Institute. It's right in the name, isn't it? He gave the resounding speech there, and he titled his speech, The Spirit of Progress. The Spirit of Progress. It was a motivating, stirring speech. Here's a quote from his speech there. Had the Mennonite Church cultivated the spirit of learning which her people originally possessed, we might be a people famed for learning, and our congregations might number thousands where now they count but hundreds. We in Mennonite education should permit nothing to prevent us from maintaining the high standard of Christian life that has been defended by the teachings of our Mennonite people through their whole history. So I was looking for the whole speech and I didn't find it. I'm sure it's available, but I didn't find it. I started looking too late. It was just actually even Monday. So that's one quote, and there's not a lot bad with that quote. He shared further here. He stated that his vision was that the school would build a culture of a consecrated heart and a self-sacrificing spirit. Beautiful desire. Kaufman believed that a Mennonite college should adopt a spirit of progress and be founded upon operating principles counter to those of the world. See, so he clarified that. It's a good statement there, I think, if you're going to do higher education. Kaufman held that the challenge of a Mennonite school would be to transform rather than conform to the models of the world. So you see the burden of his heart. We want young people to come here, Mennonite young people. We want to educate them. Maybe a little too much emphasis on changing the world through education, but we want to educate them. We want an environment that is conducive for making them into disciples of Jesus Christ in good and true Mennonite students. John S. Kaufman was very supportive of the church. But that was the speech that he gave there, and that's where I get that rest of my title for this series. I think that as I pondered the old Mennonite church era from 1850 to 2000, this thought kind of captures what I think of as the push of that. So that's why I chose it. Okay, now several of us brothers over lunch yesterday, I enjoyed this discussion very much. We were discussing this thing of progress. And the question came, it was a very good question, and I appreciate the question. The question was, is progress wrong? Is progress wrong? I want to say very clearly that I'm not opposed to progress. May God help us to make spiritual progress in our generation. May we make progress, young people. I think of, again, of Brother Danny many times talking about heat, just the vision and different ones I've heard share about our generation as young people. Our generation should be able to, in some sense, our parents want to see us go beyond them in your spiritual lives, in your spiritual journeys. They want to see you surpass them in your spiritual progress. But I remember Denny saying, don't step on us when you go by. So I'm not opposed to progress. However, I think we need to be aware who defines progress. Who's defining it? Who is defining it for us? We need to make sure that we have a biblical definition for it and not a cultural definition for progress. It needs to be a biblical definition and not a cultural definition. May our studies here this week help us to see the need for carefulness when we talk about progress and the spirit of progress. And may we make sure that our progress, our quote, progress, is not based on a reaction from the past. And one other thought I have on that is our progress must result in fruit that is Christ-likeness and not more conformed to the world. The fruit of our progress must be Christ-likeness. Obedience to the Lord Jesus Christ and His teachings. Now I will just say something here. This has helped me, and so I'm just sharing it. It came to my mind. Sometimes people ask who you are, and they want to place you in a camp, and I'm not opposed to identifying as a Mennonite or the Amish or whatever, in a sense, to try to clarify some of that sometimes, but, oh my, I could share another story. I don't know if I should. I'll just tell you quickly. I have some friends in the Maranatha Beach churches, some ministers there, and I was talking to one of them one day, and he said, you know, I was with my brother-in-law of mine in one of your churches, and we were in town, and this brother-in-law, we were together there, and he said, someone came up to us and asked us, hey, who are you all? Are you Mennonite? And his brother, this brother-in-law of his, who was in one of our churches, said, no, we're not Mennonite. And so this brother, this Maranatha minister brother, he was listening to see what he's going to say. So this man said, well, who are you? And he said, well, we would be more like the Methodists. And this Maranatha minister was shocked. The Methodists? Why do you want to identify with them? They have women preachers and gay and lesbians in the church. So that's reaction. Say, the mentality was, we are not Mennonite. We have progressed above that. I hope our progress doesn't make us Methodists when we leave the Mennonites. Do you see what I'm saying? All right. You got the point. Another little thought that helped me. I like to tell people, you know, in the Pilgrim Church, this is one distinguishing characteristic of the Pilgrim Church. I'll give you a little nugget here that more recently has came to my own heart. It's been there in other ways. I've heard teaching on it, but this has helped me. One characteristic of the Pilgrim Church. We are surrounded by Protestantism and evangelicals and even the Catholics. They focus on Christ's birth and on His death. They highlight those two aspects. Good things. I don't want to minimize that one bit. I like to tell people that we like to also focus on His life and His teachings. And that was one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Pilgrim Church. It's fine. Let's talk about His birth, His advent into the world. Let's focus on His death. It's beautiful. That has opened the way for salvation. But there's an element sometimes. We say, when we talk about the finished work of Christ, ooh boy, I'm preaching here. I'm not talking about history. Sorry. Anyway, I'll finish up here. When we talk about the finished work of Christ, many times we're referring to the cross. Okay, that's all right. But Jesus said this. Turn to John 17. Turn to John 17. Just think about this. Jesus said in John 17, this is life eternal, verse 3, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent. Can you have eternal life and not know God? No, you can't. Now, verse 4 says, Jesus is praying, I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. Had he been to the cross yet? No. And I'm not, I don't want to minimize the work on the cross one bit. But the Pilgrim Church has emphasized his life and his teachings and his example also as part of the reason that Jesus came. Not just to die on the cross. He came to teach us the will of the Father and to show us the will of the Father. All right. So now that wasn't in my notes. Okay. So our progress must result in Christ's likeness. The fruits of our progress. Now I'm going to do something that's a little dangerous. Who has the mic? Okay, read John 14 verse 6. And I tremble at this. I tried to come up with something that would help us to look at some of the things we want to look at the next 2 days. And I know that there's others have used this somewhat in talking about this. But I can honestly say as I was seeking the Lord, I felt like He gave this to me. So I want to try to use it. And I know an analogy can break down, so I tremble in that. But I want to try to help us in some of the things we're going to talk about. In John 14, verse 6, go ahead, Yura.
Jesus saith unto him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to use those three things. Jesus says, I'm the way, I'm the truth, and I'm the life. And what we're going to do here is we're going to look at this as Jesus said He's the way, He's the truth, and He's the life. Now, I want to be very careful, and I want to make it very clear that I don't want to put one of these above the other. I believe that's harmful to do that. But as we look at Mennonite history, I thought it could maybe help us if we looked at it this way. These people were strong on looking at salvation as a way of life. They were strong on that. Is that right? You understand what I'm saying? The whole way of life, that's what the old order people were strong on. They were pretty strong on doctrine. Truth, we're going to refer to that as doctrine. But they were weak over here, right? Is that right? So I didn't put these in the middle because necessarily that they have it all right. But these people, I would say, were very strong here doctrinally. And they had this, and they were lacking here, as we'll see at the beginning of the Great Awakening. But I'm afraid, I'm saying the whole thing right now, I'm afraid they moved this way too much and forgot about this. And this will make a little more sense, probably with tomorrow's session, so bear with me on that. So, we have to, another thought I want to say, when we're talking about progress, and the way I want to refer to this, the whole thing in a sense is discipleship. But I want to refer to this more as discipleship or a way of life. And so, for some reason, Jesus didn't just say, I am the truth and the life. He says, I am the way. And to help, I've just seen this more recently in Scripture. Let me read to you a few Psalms. I don't want to get out of balance in this. And the brothers, anyone here, feel free to correct me and help straighten me out on these things. I need accountability in the things I say in my studies because I don't want to get carried away. But here's a verse in Psalm 25, verse 4. David's writing there and it says, show me thy ways, and teach me thy paths. And if you follow, that thought is clear through the Bible. I hadn't seen it as much. That to follow God, He calls it a way. It's a path. It means fellowship. Young people that were at Bible school, following Christ. It means to follow Him. It means a way of life. But it's clear through, we could look at it, in thy presence is fullness of joy. No, that's not the verse I wanted. Psalm. It says, thou wilt show me the path of life. You hear over and over, it's called a path of life. It's the way of salvation. And the disciples in Acts were persecuted because of that way, it says. So just an interesting thought. You think about it. These people were strong on the way, a lifestyle, that salvation must be lived out and practically applied. These people as we look at progress, that's what I'm talking about. As we talk about progress, and feel free to, I'm just trying to help us simplify it a little bit. Hopefully I didn't confuse it. But our progress that we make must be, we can't go at progress in one of these at the detriment of the other one. See what I'm saying? We can't go progress this way at the expense of this. Okay, I appreciate the way Mickey Brubaker in a discussion one time, I'm borrowing from him. Everything I know I've learned from others, so I'll just tell you. I'm not always given credit where it goes, but a part of being a disciple is a learner. It just means a learner. All right, this is an analogy he gave. Can you all see it? I really appreciated it. Okay, here we have something. I think we were talking specifically about our view of the home. Here we had, we were talking about the charity churches. And I'll just be that plain to say it. And here we had church. So, and we talked about it, and we thought maybe in our vision for a godly home, which is tremendous and beautiful, we have maybe neglected a little bit a scriptural understanding of the church in a believer's life, the authority of the church, the place of the church, brotherhood in a believer's life. Because you know why that is? Many of us came out of situations where we can't go into that. But anyway, we got out of there because this was being abused maybe. And this is what he said. Instead of beating this down, let's not beat down what we've gained in a vision for a godly home. Let's not lower that so they're even. But let's work on raising this one. You see what I'm saying? And it's the same way here. If we're weak in one of these areas, let's not beat the other one down. But let's work on raising them up together. And Jesus Christ must be the head. I don't want to be a part of any church that Jesus Christ is not the head of. And brothers, I must have life. If you look at the whole Gospel of John, he ends that by saying, these things have I written unto you. I've written these things unto you. Let me just read it. But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through His name. So there's a strong emphasis in the book of in the Gospel of John of life. But if we go and say that Christianity is life in Christ, so to speak, it is that. But if we do that and don't also maintain a body of doctrine that is true, and we get weak and wishy-washy over here, it's probably what happened later. As they progressed and acclimated more to culture, doctrine, they lost their moorings. And so they maybe emphasize this at the expense of this or that. Are you with me? All right. So let's use that little graph to think through some of these things. That has helped me. And if I need clarification on some of those things, feel free to help me with it. And I know analogies break down. Is there someone that has a comment? Go ahead, brother. I welcome that.
Comment about the way.
Yes, good.
It seems there are a great many preachers who, according to Scripture, might not be servants of the Most High God. Of Paul and Silas, it was said by one who knew, from whatever source, by one who knew, it was said of them, these men are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation.
There you go. There it is. There's
and like you were saying, the Lord's birth, His death, gets preached, but unless we go on and show the way of salvation, it is of not much avail.
Yes, thank you, brother. Okay, and I don't want to minimize... God forbid that I would minimize the birth, the advent of Christ, His incarnation. That thrills my soul. In His death, I owe everything to the Lord in His death. He took my sins to the cross. I don't want to minimize that. Okay, so here we are. That was the introduction. All right, I have some things to go over here. I don't want to rush through it. And some of my challenges is I like details. So I got a little biography Hudson Taylor years ago. I thought that blessed me and challenged me. So then I got the 2-volume set. And that blessed and challenged me. Then one day I realized there's a 7-volume set. And I got that, of course. And that really blessed me. Because I like the details. So I can't share all the details. So my challenge is, what should I share? What shouldn't I? What do we need? What can I share that helps us to learn the things we need to learn this week? So you pray for me. I just really need that. And like I said yesterday, some things will stick out to me that it wouldn't to someone else that read the same thing, and that's part of that. Okay, so we want to open up this morning. We're going to talk about the Mennonite, what's called the Great Awakening, from the time period from 1860s through 1900. The state of the old Mennonite church in the 1950s. We mentioned this yesterday, right at the time of the Civil War. There was a need for reform. There was a tremendous need. Remember? What were some of the things that were there, quickly? Tobacco, alcohol. Young people were not joining the church. A lot of these had church services every 2 to 4 weeks. And some of these church buildings were what they called union churches. And some of them had as high as 4 different church groups on the building together. You might have Reformed and Mennonite and Brethren or Quaker or Lutheran. And they would all have it one Sunday a month. How? And then their people would end up going to the other churches as well. You see some of the problems with some of that? There's just a lot of things we could talk about. But they were at a spiritually low place. There's no question about that. I want to read here a little bit to give us some... another important influence that they were facing, we talked a little about it yesterday, was the expansion. Okay. In 1865, Mennonite Bishop John M. Brenneman from Elida, Ohio. We're going to talk more about him a little bit this morning, a little more. But we talked about his brother yesterday, Daniel M. Brenneman. We'll talk about him a little more this morning. But don't get him confused. They both were very influential people. But in 1865, Mennonite Bishop John M. Brenneman of Elida, Ohio, worried that his people, the Mennonites, were spreading too thinly. Materialism was causing too many to scatter in the West. Probably he could increase his own wealth by going, the bishop told a friend. But if a day like Noah's was coming, what good was more worldly treasure? Although a sober man, Brenneman was a kind and gentle shepherd. He saw keenly how scattering endangered the flock. He saw because he constantly traveled to serve the scattered little groups. Due to his wide contacts in the third quarter of the century, he was as close to anyone as being a leader of the North America's largest Mennonite branch, the Old Mennonite Church. In his travels, he sometimes served the Amish too. Also, in 1873, he wrote publicly that too many Mennonites settled, one family here and another there. They behaved too much like the biblical character Lot, choosing the best land no matter what Sodom and Gomorrah lay nearby. It would be much better, Brenneman continued, to go only where there was a sure prospect of immediately organizing a church. As the century progressed, Mennonites became more mission-minded and soon turned the question of settlement into a low-key debate. For evangelism, was it better to move in clusters or more individually? Okay. But for every case of success, dozens of families, listen to this, dozens of families have been lost sight of and their children carried off into mainstream Christianity. So here was a pastorly heart. I love John M. Brenneman. We'll talk more about him here in a little bit. And appreciate his influence a lot. He had a shepherd's heart. The other thing was, what happened in 1861 that affected the whole nation of America? Civil War. And they had about 70 to 80 years of peace from then till the Revolutionary War until then. So I don't know what's happening here. Okay, here. I just turned it on, I think. Okay, go ahead and hit that. We'll let that warm up. I have some pictures today. It might help you with some connections, but I don't have a lot. Okay, so the other thing that happened, I can't speak on it a lot, but the Mennonites from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, they got involved in politics, sadly. And what ended up happening when the Civil War started, I haven't run into anywhere where it has the exact statistics or gives a breakdown, but it just says that many of the Amish and Mennonite men joined the Northern Army, the Civil War. So there's quite a number that did. They were at a spiritually low place. They weren't ready for that challenge on non-resistance, evidently not. And I have a few pictures of what was happening. We talked that the young people did not join church before they got married. So there's a few pictures here. These young people, I think that's a wedding picture. That's a pretty old one there. But here on the right, you have a young couple, that's their wedding picture, 1853. And their costume did not come under church order. because they weren't baptized, they weren't members yet, but they were married. There's another one. So, I might do this. That's not going to help us. I'm not very technologically advanced here. So, we'll keep him there. That's not who we're going to talk about. I'll just have to keep that straight. Okay, so they got involved in politics, spiritually low place. They needed reform. They were lacking here. You can hear that. So here we have one thing about John M. Brenneman. In 1863, he wrote a pamphlet in the middle of the Civil War. He saw what was happening. He had a shepherd's heart. And as you'll see, he was not an educated man, but he had a burden. So he wrote a pamphlet that went out to the Mennonite churches. And the title of it was called Christianity in War. And it's beautiful. And Andrew St. Marie has actually reprinted that. I don't know if it's in print right now, but he's planning to get it reprinted. But he reprinted his pamphlet, and you can buy it from him. So he printed that in the middle of the Civil War. And then in 1867, he wrote a pamphlet or a little book called Pride in Humility. And Andrew St. Marie has also reprinted that and sells them. Two writings there, and if you study Mennonite history, there were not many writings coming out. There was one at the turn of the century, about 1800s, by probably not get it right, but I think it was Christian Burkholder, and it was an address to the youth, and it's a beautiful, beautiful paper. I should have printed some out and brought them, but you can see the difference of emphasis and focus that changed from 1800 to 1900, and here is more of an appeal made to humility. And they were basing their humility was a theme of their teaching. They had suffering in Europe. They were facing persecution, and they taught suffering. They emphasized that. And when they got to America, and the affluence and materialism that they faced, they weren't suffering as much. So the suffering message kind of changed into a message of humility. And they taught nonconformity and non-resistance should flow out of a life of humility and submission to the Lord Jesus Christ. Beautiful thought. Beautiful thought. So they kept this discipleship was still there in their teaching, even in John M. Brenneman's, although he was in a transitional period, that was still there in his writings. It's beautiful. If you look for it, you can see it. Maybe not as clear in some of the early ones. Now, the Mennonite Encyclopedia says this. That's John F. Funk. We're talking about John M. Brenneman, this pastoral man. It says he was an earnest, zealous worker in the church, and he was so absorbed in carrying out his task as overseer in the church that he gave little consideration to his temporal affairs. They said his farm work just didn't get done. He didn't make much money on his farm. It was not the most successful farm in his community. It suffered because he was traveling out, he was ministering, and so. Were there repercussions for that in his family and things? There might have been. I don't know all the results of that. But you can see his burden was to help the church and to pastor and to shepherd all these little groups that were spread out. And he just poured his life out. So I want to be careful. I don't want to criticize men like that. But I also, it says he made long, arduous trips to the West, visiting brethren who had moved into isolated communities. On one occasion, he took the train to Iowa. He took the train to Iowa to the end of the railroad. Then he drove 80 miles south in a two-horse wagon and returned east on another railroad to minister to a group of people that were there. He was away from home almost constantly, preaching, holding baptism and communion services, and seeking to bring people of both Mennonite and non-Mennonite background into the church. Although he was deeply concerned with the spiritual advancement of the church and with the scriptural doctrines and teachings, although he was deeply concerned with the spiritual advancement of the church and with the scriptural doctrines and teachings taught by the Mennonite church, he was always ready to adopt new methods. He was kind of a transitionary person. He was a pioneer in the organization of the Sunday school work in his own and other congregations. Even at the expense of losing friends or offending certain members of his own congregation, he has supported the Sunday school when they started. Even at the expense of offending other people. He saw the spiritual life was missing, and he saw the need among his people, and he wanted to encourage that and strengthen it. I think he saw that he thought Sunday schools would help with that, and they did. He was inclined to look on the dark side of life. A section in one of his books is titled, I thought this was just kind of an interesting side note. One of the sections in one of his books is titled, why a Christian should not laugh. So he was a sober fella. During his later years, shaking palsy made him inactive in the ministry. He had little formal education, but he attended elementary school with his own children. He was a prolific writer for the Herald of Truth that we'll see developed by John F. Funk, the periodical. But Funk, the editor, once said that all of his material needed complete editing. So this poor man, bless his heart, he went to school with his children, but he had a burden and a passion, and he was teaching his people non-resistance and humility, something they lost in the next 100 years, at least, yeah. So I just love this man. I'm sure he didn't make everything right, but due to his wide contacts in the third quarter of the 1800s, he was as close as anyone to being the leader of the North American Old Mennonite Church, the largest group at that time. His life was a beautiful, challenging example of devotion and sacrifice for Christ and His kingdom. So that's John M. Brenneman. Now we're going to go to John F. Funk, and that's him there, John F. Funk. I'll have to run through some of these, if you don't mind. I've got a lot of information. Can we do that a little bit? All right. You can maybe listen to it later. I don't want to just throw it at you, okay? But so it's more biographical, some of these things. But I think it helps us to understand the people. We're going to be talking about Funk and Kaufman especially more the next 2 days. John F. Funk, 1835 through 1930. He's probably the outstanding leader of the Mennonite Church in the 19th century. And by that, I know I just read that about John M. Brenneman. By that, but John M. Brenneman was fading out by the 1870s and 80s, or 1870s and 80s. And John F. Funk was rising up in 1870s and 80s. And John F. Funk was probably the most influential one. He spent the first 22 years of his life in Pennsylvania in the Franconia Conference, and then he left to go to Chicago to make his fortune. There he felt pulled two ways. With building and other activity booming, he joined a prospering lumber business, dressed smartly, it's probably somewhat there, attended a commercial college and various clubs and political rallies. In 1858, he was converted in a Presbyterian revival with D.L. Moody. With a Presbyterian revival. Here he met and associated intimately with D.L. Moody. Now, there's some variation on different historians how much influence he actually had from Moody, but this particular book said that he met and associated intimately with D.L. Moody, to whom he attributed much of the influence which moved him into active Christian service with progressive ideas in Sunday school evangelism and religious publication, far in advance of the lethargic mid-century Mennonite church of his fathers. So here you have a man rising up, got clearly converted, praise God, but he started have tremendous influence in the Mennonite church as a young man. He returned to the Mennonite church and was baptized and joined in 1860 and was ordained in the ministry in 1865. He was ordained in a little congregation 50 miles south of Chicago in Illinois. He started publishing a Mennonite paper. I think it was 1864. He had an English and a German version. You've heard of it, Herald of Truth, and the German was Der Herald der Wahrheit. So he had those two publications. One was in German, one was in English. And I think this. Can someone tell me? Was this a monthly publication? I think. You don't know offhand. Okay, I should have checked. I think it was, you're saying yes? Yeah, I think it was a monthly publication. So here, in 1864, in the middle of the Civil War, it was toward the end of it, I guess, he started publishing this periodical, and it went out into the scattered Mennonite churches. In 1867, he moved to Elkhart, Indiana. He moved his publishing business there. And then in 1875, his publishing company incorporated and officially became what was called the Mennonite Publishing Company, 1875. He had very powerful influence over the Mennonite church through his publishing company. His periodicals went out to most of the Mennonite homes, and the Amish got them too, and probably General Conference people probably got them too. But the Mennonite Encyclopedia says that he was, by all odds, the most influential leader for 30 years of the whole Old Mennonite Church by his influence from 1870 to 1900. And he was shaping, his influence shaped the course of the Mennonite church. It helped to shape it. Now, he stood firmly against the Methodistic type of more emotional piety, like Daniel Brenneman and the Mennonite Brethren of Christ. We talked about that yesterday. John F. Funk was part of the Yellow Creek Church. I'll try to keep you with me. He was part of the Yellow Creek Church there in Goshen. He moved to Elkhart with his publishing company, and then he was part of the Yellow Creek Mennonite Church in Goshen. And we talked about how they divided in 1872, and there were three factions there. You had the revivalist faction, which was Daniel M. Brenneman, John M. Brenneman's brother. You had Daniel M. Brenneman, who was pushing for a more pietistic, experiential, Methodist-type revivalism. And I'll read a little bit about that. And so you had him, and then you had Jacob Whistler, who was pushing against Sunday schools and protracted revival meetings. You had those, and then you had John Funk in the middle. You remember how I told you that? Are you with me, young ladies? Are you totally asleep? All right. You didn't shake your head yes for that. So he was in the middle. This was John Funk. This was turned into Jacob Whistler. And we would say Daniel Brenneman ended up way out here even. He went out faster. Okay, so those were the three factions. It's saying here that John F. Funk stood against Daniel M. Brenneman. He didn't go the way of the highly pietistic, emotional Methodist type of revivalism. And he didn't support Jacob Whistler in his old order ways. John F. Funk guided the church. And so we know how that ended up. Jacob Whistler was excommunicated there and started the old order Whistler group. And John was minister there, but he wasn't ordained as a bishop there until 1892. So they must have had someone else that came in as a bishop. They did. I can't remember who it was. But anyway, he was kind of middle of the road. Question? Does someone have a question? Yes, please clarify. That was 36-year-old John F. Funk expelled, something like that, his 63-year-old bishop, over this Sunday school issue. But the committee, the Indiana-Michigan Conference, was behind him. I mean, they had sent a committee, and they had admonished Jacob Whistler and given him time, but John F. Funk's problem was he was a little too stubborn and young man, probably, a little too zealous. He expelled him, Jacob Whistler, before the committee came in and did it. That was what he shouldn't have done. Should have waited on the conference. What was your question? Okay, thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that. Anyone else? Okay. So that's where he was. John F. Funk guided the church, speaking of the old Mennonite church, in a gradual change down the middle road, and is more responsible than any other one man, teamed with John S. Kaufman, for the general character of the Mennonite church in the 20th century, in its middle of the road position, between tradition on one hand and undirected progress on the other. Talked about progress, undirected progress on the other. He strongly encouraged Sunday schools, revival meetings, missions, and higher education. He was one man that had all this influence by himself. He was a minister, but there was no real accountability. I'm sure he got letters back from ministers and things, challenged him on things, but as a whole, rose up by himself and had this prominence or influence, without a lot of accountability to the church. Now that might not be fair. So receive that way. I want to be fair in my evaluations. A major force for old Mennonite unity. Here's some of the good things that he did. He did a lot of good things and had a good focus, a powerful focus in his life. I don't want to just make it bad. But the major force of old Mennonite unity was the publications of John F. Funk, a denominational entrepreneur in Elkhart, Indiana. Okay, we'll talk some about that. Through his paper, Funk promoted his renewal agenda, a grounding in Anabaptist Mennonite historical literature. Okay, that's right. Here's what I wanted. Both Funk's aggressive style and his programs for change were controversial among Mennonites, oriented to humility and tradition. Well before 1890, however, John succeeded in getting most of the old and Amish Mennonites to consider the Herald of Truth to be their own paper. His New Year's editorial of that year showed how John Funk equated his own work with the work of the church. So I'll read a quote here from him. But okay, so I just said that he was influencing the church without a lot of accountability. His heart was that the whole Mennonite church would see the Mennonite Publishing House as the publishing house of their church. He wanted them to see it that way. I don't think that's a bad thing. Here's his quote. Brethren and sisters, come up to the work like the men in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem in the days of Nehemiah. Let the Mennonite church be our church. Let Mennonite doctrines be our doctrines. Let Mennonite principles and practices be our principles and practices. Let the Mennonite people be our people. Let the Herald of Truth be our paper. Let the Mennonite bookstore and the Mennonite printing office be our bookstore and printing office. It's interesting that he wrote this. We'll see what happened 10 years later. Let us help to support and sustain it, and therewith support and sustain the church. See, it's a beautiful appeal, saying we want you to see this as yours and as part of the church. Now, it seems to me that John F. Funk, John M. Brenneman especially, had a burden. So he saw the need for, the church needed reform, and it needed to be quickened. It needed life. And John F. Funk had the same burden. And they were cautious. I don't want to just make it sound like they weren't cautious. But they moved to revitalize the church. They moved cautiously. Yet it seems like there was a difference in the spirit, even of those two. You had John M. Brenneman, who was a little older man, representing a different era almost, uneducated. Here comes John F. Funk, educated now, with some college education. And he starts, he was converted there in Chicago, in the Presbyterian church, and started having this influence. John M. Brenneman was uneducated and promoted a humility and accountability to the church. He still was emphasizing this pretty strongly. John F. Funk was more educated and functioned in a more independent way, drawing pretty heavy on Protestant sources and ideas in his periodicals. He did print Anabaptist and Mennonite historical literature. I don't want to make it sound like he didn't. About the time of the Civil War, old and Amish Mennonites began slowly to open their windows to new breezes. Early on, a window opened to Sunday schools. Apparently, the first ongoing Sunday school among old and Amish Mennonites after temporary starts began in 1863 among the Amish at West Liberty, Ohio. But before that, for a generation thereafter, the Sunday school-minded also participated in union, which are interdenominational schools, Sunday schools, or in those of other churches. So in the Sunday school movement, their people were going to Sunday school with other church groups. So there was a valid desire to bring Sunday school and have their own Mennonite Sunday schools. I don't criticize them for those things, and I don't just criticize Sunday school either. As a youth, John F. Funk attended and taught in a Baptist Sunday school. Another window opened quite early to publishing and bookselling, especially for 20 or 25 years after beginning his Herald of Truth and Herald der Wahrheit in 1864, Funk took articles wholesale from Protestant journals. He also advertised and marketed many Protestant books. The old and Amish Mennonites opened their windows only cautiously and partially. Much like later pastors warning against television preachers, here's John F. Funk with a warning of his own. It's beautiful. Funk warned in 1893 that too many Mennonites were reading Talmage and Moody and Spurgeon and other authors and newspapers without knowing the writings of their own church. So you see, already he's seeing some problem. In 1893, this was 30 years after he started pushing some of those things. Without knowing the writings of their own church. In 1890, he began to publish Sunday school lesson commentaries so that his people would be less inclined to use interdenominational ones. Many, for instance, were buying from David Cook, a freelancing publisher in Chicago. By 1890, many Mennonites surely saw their Sunday schools as protection against others' doctrines rather than a window of interdenominationalism. But however cautiously, old and Amish Mennonites were breathing However cautiously, they were breathing Protestant breezes. And given the connections between a generalized Protestant outlook and 19th century civil religion, they breathed American culture as well. By opening themselves to American Protestantism, Mennonites and Amish Mennonites found a religiously approved way to become American. John F. Funk was ordained as a bishop in 1892. The other thing is, we'll have to talk about this some other day, but he strongly supported and advocated that the old Mennonite church, which was made up of 13, let's say, whatever those It went up to maybe 15 or 17 district conferences. We looked at them yesterday. It was made up of Lancaster Conference, Franconia, all those different district conferences. He strongly pushed, helped to promote with a few other people, that those district conferences would all assemble once a year into their own general conference. So there would be accountability among the whole group. Do you see what I'm saying? They wanted to bring them more together, which is not all bad, I don't think. So he helped to encourage that they would form into a general conference, these more regional conferences. In 1898, that happened. The first one happened in the Old Mennonite Church. They gathered with representatives and delegates from most of the regional conferences. Lancaster, Franconia, Virginia, and I don't think Washington County, Mennonites, I don't think that they were joined that, but they did send delegates for years, and they were connected to it. But they didn't support it, I don't think, and didn't join it. I don't know that I should read all this. I'm actually running out of time here. Maybe I was just trying to tell you about it, and you could read it. It's kind of a sad ending for John F. Funk. I don't mean this to put him down. My hat is off to him. He labored and poured out his life again. He did what he was sure was right. And the church did need revival. It needed reform. It needed spiritual life. It did need that. But I'm afraid that he lost some of this in the process. Do you follow me? And we'll talk more about the next 2 days, probably. We'll actually talk about some of the fruits of this renewal movement, because it kept showing up for the next couple of generations. But I don't want to push him down. He labored abundantly and he poured out his life. So, okay. The Old Mennonite General Conference of 1898 moved quickly to become a central government to define Orthodox teachings and to control Old Mennonite institutions. So he helped say, we need a general conference to bring all these regional district conferences together. We want to bring them all together. So they, and when that happened, they says they moved quickly to define Orthodox teachings and to control the old Mennonite institutions, which one of them was the Mennonite Publishing Company. And the Mennonite Church is saying, you've had all this influence all this time. Now we need some accountability. We want to bring your institution into this conference with some accountability and a board to look over it, which it happened later. The first, according to a preliminary meeting in 1897, the first object of conference was to bring about a closer unity of sentiment on gospel principles. Such unity resulting from closer spiritual intercourse would mean weeding out heretical doctrines and consequent purity of the church. That's what they were saying. That's why they wanted to centralize and to come together in more of a general conference. We want to purify the church. It's a good thing, a good desire. The conference organizers said they did not intend to assert legislative authority over district conferences and congregations. We're not going to assert authority over the local congregations and districts. Yet, phrases such as to centralize and to direct implied that somehow the conference would exist binding power. At least it would exert power over church institutions such as publications, homes for orphans, the elderly, and missions, plus their boards. It would also establish acceptable church doctrine and behavior. Daniel Kaufman, then only 33, presided over or moderated the first general conference meeting. We'll hear more about him later this week. Immediately, the new body appointed a committee to investigate all organizations that wished to be considered as church institutions. The conference would recognize only those institutions which met its standards for purpose, composition, management, and character. In 1900, at its second meeting, it accepted several. An old people's home in Rittman, Ohio, and an orphan's home in West Liberty, Ohio, the forerunner of Goshen College, which was Elkhart Institute, a Mennonite evangelizing and benevolent board at Elkhart, and a Mennonite aid plan, whose treasurer was in Scottsdale, Pennsylvania. None of the institutions was centered in the old heartland of eastern Pennsylvania, even though the heaviest concentrations of Mennonite population were there. The conference never assumed legal control and actual direction of the institutions, but general conference approval became very important to these institutions and for those which came later. Now, in an official conference sermon at the first meeting, John F. Funk acclaimed the new organization to be the consummation of 25 years of planning. Before the second meeting, however, Funk reversed his position and spoke out against the conference organization. A struggle had emerged with Daniel Kaufman and others pitted against him, most directly for the control of the old Mennonite publishing company. Funk now argued that the conference founders had moved too rapidly without adequate mandate from the district conferences and congregations. It's interesting. That's what happened. And Funk refused to apply for general conference endorsement. He wouldn't apply for endorsement from the larger conference that he helped bring together. Sadly, there was a local dispute in Funk's congregation there at Yellow Creek. He was a bishop. He was charged with acting arbitrarily in a conflict involving the Elkhart Institute and the congregation. And the Indiana-Michigan Conference convened a committee of 5 ordained men to investigate, made up of leaders from 4 district conferences of Lancaster, Virginia, Ohio, and Kansas, Nebraska. The committee recommended that Funk be suspended as bishop. He was never restored to the office. And that was in 1902. In 1903, a failure of a local bank put his Mennonite publishing company into bankruptcy. 4 years later, a fire destroyed half of its plant. Meanwhile, a rival group at Scottsdale, Pennsylvania, organized the Gospel Witness Company and began to publish a periodical called the Gospel Witness. The new paper competed directly with the Herald of Truth, and by 1908, Funk sold out to his rivals. At that point, the younger leaders founded a church-owned publishing house, a church-wide publication board, and an officially sanctioned denominational paper called the Gospel Herald. In the judgment of one observer, Funk's Herald of Truth had become an easy prey to leaders who were younger, aggressive, and well organized. Funk's leadership was finished, even though he lived till 1930. He lost his place as a bishop. He lost his publishing company. These young men, the next generation, took it away from him. In some ways, I'm sure there's fault on his side, too. But that's the type of spirit that was coming in. That's just one little picture. And I wish Christ was here and tell us exactly who faults that were there. But that's the story. He lost his ministry and his business, which had actually been fairly successful in business at one time. But he died as a poor man. He came to church with patched up suits. And the publishing company moved to Scottsdale, Pennsylvania in 1908 under the publication board for the general conference. That's not these people. I'm sorry. The general conference of the old Mennonite church. It's confusing. I'm sorry. It seems like his life was characterized by a little more of an independence, a strong-willed type of Christianity. It was lacking maybe some of the humility that older Mennonites had emphasized, and a clear vision of teaching the gospel as a way, not just, we need life, brothers, we need life, but if we lift this, remember, at the cost of this, it won't work out right. Either way, in any of those. Is there any questions? Maybe I'll just quit there. I had a few more thoughts here with him. I don't want to murder his person. I feel like he sowed seeds, but I feel like he sowed seeds in his life and ministry that bore fruits of progressivism, or bore fruits of progress in the next generation that helped move the Mennonite church in a direction of individualism and professionalism, and ultimately into the more of the American culture, which that took some years to happen, and they actually almost came back some, I think, in the next era. We'll talk about that some, hopefully, as we go along. I kind of associate him and the publishing company with the Sunday school movement. And I want to say, the Sunday school movement, I don't think was a bad thing. Some of you who were involved with it or had it or have more insight can share with it. I don't think it was a bad thing seeing where the Mennonite church was. I think there were many benefits from the Sunday school movement. It brought a quickening. It helped to do that. It brought in more of an analytical approach to the scriptures. People were now encouraged to think as they opened the scriptures and look at it more analytically instead of just extemporaneous preaching where you open the Bible. So these people were taught, and I think it encouraged a lot of things there. But I think they drew pretty heavy from Protestant sources, and I think it did influence the Mennonite church in a Protestant direction. I think people got more excited about Sunday school than they did about church. And so the Sunday school was kind of a movement among the church. You see what I'm saying? But to many people, it replaced the church. They lost their clear vision of the church as a brotherhood. that the Anabaptists had defined Anabaptism from the Reformers in some ways. They lost some of that, and they got wrapped up in a movement. The Sunday school movement was a little more of a movement, and probably did not have the emphasis of the church. Yes, Brother Dale.
I really appreciate what you're sharing, but I just would like to stamp it deeper on my own heart and everyone's maybe, to requote just a couple things that you said.
Sure.
One of them, when John Funk was putting out his publication, you made this statement. I think you were reading from the book, so it's probably the book that made it, that the Mennonites were breathing Protestant breezes. I just sat here and thought about that. You made a statement about some organization, I'm not sure what it was, maybe from the book, that they sent delegates, but they didn't join.
Yes.
There's just a little too much hand in hand, a little too much exposure. I just think that one thing we need to learn from all of this history, yes, that you're presenting so balanced and so faithfully, is that there's a point to shut off those Protestant breezes.
Yes.
We're in a world of technology, and we are breathing. You could say Protestant breezes, but whatever breezes you want to put there.
That's right.
And it comes into our home.
Christianity.
And I just sit here and I listen to this history, and it just sounds like these things take their effect, like you described, down the road. These seeds, these are seeds that come up. And when children come of age, you know, we're just not sure where all the change took place, but they just don't see everything.
Right. That's right.
Like the forefathers that we're trying to be faithful to. Faith of our fathers is not our all in all.
That's right.
But it is a balance.
Yes.
And I just have been blessed by some of these comments. May we learn from these teachings here that you're bringing to us. May God have his way. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Brother Dale. Appreciate that. I'm not a protester against the Protestant. I don't want to come across that way. Sometimes that can be, but I think we need to understand that, and we'll get into this more clearly tomorrow, hopefully, about some of the differences in even their view of salvation and how it has affected us. It affected me. And I'm not the judge on those things, but these are things I've been looking at. So I appreciate that. I'll get to you in just a second. One clarification. I think I was going plenty fast. And maybe, did most of you get, when they sent delegates, they were not going, Brother Dale, to a Protestant conference. It was their general conference of like Franconia, Lancaster, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. They all came together in all these district conferences formed I put it on the wrong side. Anyway, it's not associated to that. But they formed their own, what became called the General Conference. That was separate, these people did, that was separate from them. And Lancaster and Franconia, in Virginia, were more conservative, and they never officially joined or didn't for a long time, but they did send delegates into this. And so they had interaction and they had influence. But he helped to bring those churches together into a general conference, Funk did. But then when they said, okay, we want accountability for all the church institutions, it created a problem for him. And maybe there were I'm sure there were other things that influenced that. And I want to, yes, Brother Ura.
I just had one quick thought on the Sunday school, a question, I guess I could say. They needed more life.
That's right.
And Sunday school probably looked like a solution to some of them for, to study the Word of God, et cetera. But who were the people behind the Sunday school movement, as far as who were they looking up to? Even though Sunday school was not necessarily a bad thing, who was influencing them in that direction?
Well, I think there were certain more individuals that were, John Funk was, John M. Brenneman was cautiously, as an older man, he was okay with that. I think he saw the need for the quickening and thought this would be a blessing. And then you had John F. Funk and then John S. Kaufman, we'll talk about tomorrow. And there were probably some others, but there were some of those people more, especially Funk more in the beginning, and I think he promoted it through his publication pretty heavily and maybe even had some Sunday school lessons in it earlier on. So he was pushing for that. I think like people like Jacob Whistler, that did not embrace Sunday school. I think some of the reason he didn't and some of those people were concerned is because the Indiana-Michigan Conference did adopt it and support it, but I think some of those men saw how there were certain individuals pushing this and it wasn't the whole church behind it. Does that make sense? It came out of a few individuals instead of from the top down, so to speak. I can say that. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess I was wondering as far as weren't the Protestants behind the whole...
The original, yes.
So it seemed to me that maybe they did have a little bit of an unhealthy appreciation for a lot of Protestants.
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah, the Sunday school movement started with the Protestants. Was it in England, I think? I don't know quite the history, but it's in the 1800s there. If he knows, he can help us. It started among the Protestants, and what happened is these Protestants had Sunday schools around in the same communities as the Mennonites did, and they let their young people go and their people go. And they thought, well, this is a blessing. You know, we're learning all these things because they were needing some quickening. So then the Mennonite people said, well, we should have our own Sunday schools, so they're not going over there, which was probably, you know, right thinking. But the whole they didn't have their own literature and their own things to implement it. These are a few things I said that I think the Sunday school movement helped replace the church a little bit. The other thing that it did is it encouraged lay leadership, which I'm not necessarily opposed to all the brothers being involved in those things, which was good, I think. It encouraged lay leadership, which was good. It also gave some of these lay leaders almost more influence in the church than the ministers had, because they were the one teaching the young people Sunday school. The other thing it did is it opened the door for women to play an active role in the church. The women started, in some churches, Sunday schools might easily have, in some churches, the Sunday schools might easily have more women teachers than men. They also gave a few, and some of the women started giving some addresses at their new Sunday school conventions. They patterned it after the Protestants, had their own Sunday school conventions. Some of the women even started giving addresses there and stuff. So there was other influence. Go ahead, Brother Reuben.
If I've got it right, the Wesleys, as much as anyone, were the originators of the Sunday school.
Yes.
England was really in a moral cesspool when the Wesleys appeared on the scene, and God used them to reverse a lot of that.
Say that again, Reuben.
England was in a moral cesspool. England was dreadfully down the tube at the time.
Yes.
One man said, and he said, this pretty much applies to North America at this time. He said, England was in a condition where stomach is alive and well, soul is extinct. Mm. When the Wesleys came on the scene, and Charles says he preached in a prison once where there were 60 people on death row, one of them a 10-year-old child. The moral situation was dreadful in England at the time, and this was part of their effort to
raise the morale.
Right.
Yeah.
And personally, from what I gathered of it, was that it was good.
Yes.
But then, of course, like everything good, the enemy's going to be working on it, and if he can, take it the wrong way.
Yeah. That's good. I'm sure there was a lot of good that came out of it. I personally would feel one of the more challenging to see how integrated it was. I think the churches, a lot of the Mennonite churches today that have it, like Easter Nationwide, the Beachy churches, they have their own publications, and they don't have the Sunday school conventions and all that going on. It's more of a localized, and I think it can have some benefit there. But it became a movement, even in the Protestant church, that kind of displaced the church, took the church out of the focus. We'll take one more. I don't want to take Reuben's
time. Do we have time is the first question for a brief history on Sunday school, if you want one.
Okay, good.
Originally, the Sunday school movement was started not even for the church. It was an evangelistic tool.
Yes, thank you.
To children that during the week could not go to school because they were forced to work in England. It was started in England. And so the only time they had off was on Sunday, so they actually started an educational facility based on the Bible and things like that, so that the church was using it as a tool, I think it was the Baptist, if I'm not mistaken, to minister to the young children that didn't have any education otherwise, they were teaching them in Sunday school the day they had off. And so that became an influence for to the unreached children. It gradually moved into the church and replaced the teachings of the home and the fathers.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that's right.
And became the source of instruction in the church. And I think that was what, and it was needed in that the church was not alive.
Yeah.
The Baptist church and the rest of the churches, the Wesleyan churches, didn't have the home life that should have been teaching those principles according to Leviticus and Deuteronomy. That they weren't getting it from their parents. And so the church supplied that. And I think that was one of the weaknesses in the Sunday school movement, is that if it replaces the teaching from the home, then you're not going to come out with good fruit in the end. If it's supplemental to the family, then it can have a benefit, I think.
Good. Thank you for that. That is very helpful. Because that history helps a lot. Brother Leonard has his hand up.
Just a little bit of a different angle here. Some of you younger ones here might find some of this laborious and uninteresting. I would like to encourage you that when the responsibility for decisions and the outcome of your lives becomes more significant, some of these things might become more important in your thinking. And I just would like to encourage us to gird up the loins of our mind and seek to understand and grasp what we can. Most of our lives is built one cell upon another, one bit of information upon another. And if we are ignorant, not only we are going to bear the consequences. Would like to make one other comment, as there are future church leaders here. When the Lord, I trust by faith, when the Lord gives to a man an ambition, a vision, a zeal, others may not be on board as fully as what maybe I feel or we feel things should be. And they're so easy for a spirit of pride to come in because the Lord gave this to me as a gift. And obviously, if you didn't have me, you wouldn't be where you are. And so why are you critiquing me and limiting me and holding me back? In another place, I had that feeling. But I think its origins are prideful. A man can have nothing and maintain nothing except God gives. And so I think we need each other. We need the body. We need to work together as a people. If the Lord gives us a gift, let's not run away.
That's good. Thank you very much for that. And please ask questions. Like I said, my heart is not to come here and dump a bunch of information. I know it's stretching. And so it's new to me, too. The last 5 years of study has been so. And I'm sure I'm not getting it all right. But I welcome your questions. Thank you for those comments. And God bless you.